everyone. My name is Grace Okafor, and welcome to another episode of the podcast Conversations for a Life Economy. The series is brought to you by the British charity Reboot the Future and by the Institute for Ecological Civilization, ecosave.org. The most universal ethical principle in history is called the Golden Rule. Treat others as you wish to be treated. What would it mean to extend this idea to the environment? John Perkins calls the result a life economy, living in ways that foster mutually beneficial relationships between human activities and the environment, driven by the goal of maximizing long-term benefits for both people and the planet. Each Life Economy podcast episode features a significant leader who is working toward this goal. We take a deep dive into the values and experiences that drive their work, the transformations they are working toward, and the ways that listeners can succeed at similar initiatives in their own life. Our guest today is Aaron Simon, head of plastic waste and business at World Wildlife Fund. Aaron's expertise is in material science, design innovation, procurement, manufacturing, and logistical and point-of-purchase aspects of packaging. At the onset of her career, she spent 10 years at Hewlett-Packard, working as a packaging engineer responsible for the design and implementation of laser jet printer and media packaging. In 2011, Aaron joined WWF and over the next decade assumed several senior positions across the organization. In her current role, she works to drive positive change across industries by leading WWF's Packaging and Material Science program. Aaron works with business and industry to help them make informed, sustainable material choices for their products and packaging. Her work focuses on the major commodities that go into packaging and how to integrate sustainability into the decisions and trade-offs within a product's life cycle. Through her efforts, Aaron works with companies to strategically solve two key issues: focusing on developing transparency in the supply chain for major packaging materials, and pursuing strategies that reduce the environmental impact of these materials through responsible sourcing. It's with great pleasure we introduce Aaron Simon. I'll now hand the floor over to our co-host for today's podcast episode, Ecosyst President Philip Clayton.
Hey, Aaron, it's a privilege to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for including me today.
We have some sense of the work that you're currently engaged in with the World Wildlife Fund. And I think what we'd like to do first is to get some sense of what would have led you to the kind of position that you've been carrying out and the leadership roles you've been playing. I guess I want to ask you the wide open question. How did you become so passionate about the environment? Where does it come from in your life history?
It's really hard to narrow down, you know, pinpoint that one moment in time. But for as long as I can remember, being outside, being surrounded by nature, by just the most magnificent, you know, ecosystems and places in the world, that has always brought me such calmness. It has helped to quiet my mind and settle me, especially when I'm stressed out or overwhelmed. And so I can remember that as, you know, I can remember laying in the grass as a kid, you know, after being so upset about some injustice that was clearly brought upon me, which may have just been I couldn't watch TV in that moment. But I remember that was where I would go, right? And that is still the same today in the latter half of my life.
Take us to a place in nature that brings you that sort of calm that fills your soul, a place that you know that you go back to. Can you lead us there? Can you make us hear it and see it and smell it?
Yeah, you know, over my life, obviously, things have gotten crazier as we take on more responsibility, as our passions drive us to do more things. I feel like that the need I have to recharge in nature has become stronger and stronger. And of course, over the pandemic, that became really intense. And so we made the delightful COVID purchase of a little tiny river house off of Hull Creek and the Chesapeake Bay here in Virginia, in the Northern Neck. And I remember when we bought the house, the seller said that as you leave Richmond and get closer and closer to the Northern Neck, you are going to slowly feel your body's tension release out of you. And it is so true, because as we get there and we head down the single lane road, the single lane dirt road onto this tiny point where this tiny little cottage sits, it's like I just go there and I'm like, I know the world is going to be fine while I'm gone, but I just don't need to worry about it in that moment, right? And we get there, and the first thing we always do is grab a nice beverage and walk down to the dock and just sit there in the quiet, you know, smelling the salty, breezy bay air, listening to the wind in the trees, and just watching nature exist. And it just, I just love it. It just makes me, it helps me recharge. It fills my bucket. It's the thing I need to do these days, not only to relieve some of that pressure, but also just to remember why we're doing all the crazy that we are, what we're trying to protect, you know?
It's a beautiful description of what it's like to be grounded by nature.
Mm-hmm.
I get a sense of a way of being in the world that is inseparable from the natural environment. You couldn't sustain your work with WWF if you didn't have that. Is that accurate?
I think that's really true. I think you just have to, I mean, well, for one, I can't help but look at nature and be utterly amazed by it, right? Its resilience, the magic in nature, and just its ability to soothe, right? You like can't sit in a forest and hear that wind rustling through the trees and not just almost feel it in your heart, right? It sort of like slows down the breathing, slows down, you know, your body. And I just, yeah. So I spend time as I'm talking to you, I'm like, I've got two windows, right? And I've got like blue jays and, you know, to my left and just, you know, crazy crows that continue to harass the hawks in front of me. But yeah, those are the things that just sort of drive me. It reminds me that this is like what we're trying to protect. This is what I want to thrive, not roads and cities. I want, you know, wide open spaces in nature.
I met you in a private conversation hosted by Kim Pullman of Reboot the Future. And it describes some of the suffering of animals. And I had the sense for many of us on that call that there was a deep empathy with nature, with other living things. Do you have that? Have you had that a long time? And what role does it play?
I think as a very sort of emotive, like empathetic person, I have a hard time seeing any living being suffer, right? I struggle with that. My husband often is concerned when we're driving and I like threaten the entire livelihood of the folks in the car in order to save the squirrel, you know? But yeah, I feel like I can't look at any of the images or hear any of the stories of animals suffering because humans have just sort of pushed into their space a little too much, or we've done something that's really affected their ecosystem or their ability to reproduce. And it's so frustrating because I think if we had understood that, if we could have been more thoughtful about it, we could have done something to stop it in the first place. So I just don't feel like that was our right. I don't think we were placed on the planet to just harm so many different species so we could thrive. I don't think that was the intention. I absolutely do feel that empathy for species, for animals, for ecosystems. It gives me purpose.
If this question's not too personal, I'd like to ask you, how has it affected that empathy for nature, that sense of connection with nature and calling to be a voice for the animals that suffer and the ecosystems that suffer, to become a mother? How has that affected that role for you?
Well, I mean, I think I've said this before, but, you know, becoming a mother was, wow, right? That's life-changing. And I know they tell you that when you endeavor into that, you know, that adventure, but it changes, you know, it changed my outlook. It changed what, you know, how I thought about things. It changed those, you know, from looking at the short-term close benefits to like really thinking long-term. I don't have to think about the world I will live in until my time here is gone. I have to think about hers and what about her children's, you know? So it's really important to me that I am part of that, the work that is helping to preserve that future for her. And I'm not just talking about so she can go on a safari and see elephants and rhinos. Yes, that's a bare minimum. I want her to have access to fresh water, to clean air to breathe, to be able to go to a beach and not have to clean the trash up first, you know, to be able to walk outside and see thriving, you know, forests and species. And I don't feel like, I wish that wasn't something that I had to be so concerned about protecting. But I tell you what, having a child makes me just that more, just that much more driven and determined to make sure that that I do something about that. So yeah, sky is really at the heart of a lot of the things that I do. I don't know. I'm guessing a lot of mothers have the same experience, but she makes me want to be a better person, and she makes me want to do more to make the world a better place for her.
That's beautifully put. One of the things that Reboot the Future and EcoSIF talk about are values for a life economy, a way of living in interaction with nature that fosters life rather than squelching it. And it leads me to want to ask you the somewhat broader question. What are some of the values that are at the center of your own economy, family economy, work economy, your own inner economy? What are the values that make you tick, if that's not too personal to ask?
No, that's fine, right? I think it starts with kindness. Let's just be good humans, right? Let's treat others well. Let's respect. That's not just other people. That's the planet and, you know, and species. Like, let's just be good to one another. It really doesn't take a lot of work. Let me be clear. I think secondly, openness, right? I have a lot of expertise and ideas and thoughts, but I by no means can solve anything on my own. And I have to be open to listening and learning and hearing where other people are coming from, because that is the only way that we are going to find a path forward. And I think that really builds onto like my third value, which is all about growth and learning. I have so much that I still need to learn and understand, not just about technical topics, because that is a constantly growing space, but just about cultures, where people come from, what they value, because both, I'm just fascinated. I love people's stories, right? Like, they tell you so much about where they come from and how they're thinking about things. But also, you know, in the Western world, we get so sort of myopic in what we've grown up with or what we know, and we lose touch with the rest of the world. And so I just feel like the more I've seen, the more people I've met, I think I become just better, because I just have a lot more respect for a larger variety and diversity, you know, a diverse set of people. So I'd like to, those values, I think, are just really important for not only me and my work, but I'm trying to teach Sky those things so she can, you know, learn that earlier in life. I don't think I totally understood that early on. But yeah, those are I think that's really the core of it.
One last question begs to be asked. Because many of the listeners to the podcast are themselves in positions of major responsibility in various organizations. How separate is your work life from these things, these core values that you've described in your home and your relationship with Sky and with nature? Or how integrated, how tied together are they? Help us understand that work-life balance is the way one usually puts the question. But I'm more wondering how the one bleeds over into the other. Do they, for you, kind of all connect together, or do they feel like they're two separate parts of your life?
For better or for worse, I am, you know, I feel like I always have to just show up with all of those feelings, emotions, and passion in work or in personal life. And so you could argue I have very little work-life balance because of that. But it does, I think part of it is I want to show up authentically. Who I am with all of my vulnerabilities and imperfections, that's who's gotten me here today. I find that at times that allows me to break down some pretty tough conversations, because I just am sort of like, well, this is me. Like, I know that's not perfect. I'm listening. I want to hear. Here's my idea. Do you disagree? You know, I can do that also as a parent, because I get it wrong all the time. Let me be clear. I'm not a parent who thinks they've got it figured out. I fail miserably. But yeah, like, I just kind of show up the same way. Right. I think that can feel heavy at times, hence the need to go, you know, recharge. But I don't walk away at the end of my work day and feel like who people saw was not who I want to represent, or that I didn't embody the passion, concern, thoughtfulness, intentionalness that I needed to in my work. So,
Erin, thanks for giving us a deeper sense of who you are and of what drives your work.
No problem.
Erin, we'd love to shift gears a bit and just paint a better picture of the kind of work that you are doing in your current role at WWF and the impact that WWF is really trying to have in the world. So we've been talking a lot about how your values are kind of bleeding in and informing your decisions in your leadership. But can you just share and describe what does that look like on a day-to-day basis of the work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So World Wildlife Fund is one of the world's largest conservation networks. And really at the heart of what its mission is to protect the people and planet for future generations. It's not really hard to get behind that mission, is it? And so my work as a part of that is to think about how we interact with nature to provide the things that humanity depends on every day. So how we take things from the planet to make them into products and what we do when we're done with them. And so I take a lot of the science and engineering and material science background that I have, and I put a conservation lens on it. And I think about who do I need to engage? Who do I need to influence, inspire, excite, and empower, right, with this information in order for them to do what they can to change, right? My job is really often sharing knowledge with others so they can reach their full potential, right? I spend a lot of time working with businesses, trying to understand the challenges they have, helping them to understand the role they have to play in these issues, and therefore creating more ambition around their targets and the way they're, you know, implementing strategies and solutions to sort of solve for those. With the plastic waste issue, which is where I spend a lot of time these days, it's really trying to inspire everybody around the outcomes we all share, right? We all want plastic to stop ending up in nature because we know it creates a mess, both figuratively and literally when it's there. And we know that everybody has a role to play. So how can we get everybody sort of working towards that systems change we're looking for? And so I do that with companies, making sure they're doing it credibly, right? So if you think about that, I want to lead with science always, because I need to make sure that what they're doing is credible and meaningful. But at the same time, I need to use that passion to get them to reach a little bit higher next time. And that's what I'm constantly asking them to do. I'll be like, you did great, but let's do a little bit more. I've been really excited to see in the plastic waste space how quickly things are moving. It feels really slow. From anybody who doesn't spend every day in this space, you're probably like, well, we're not really doing that much, are we? But we are. We're making more moves than we have on any other issue in the past. And so for that, it gives me a lot of hope and it helps me to recover when I'm feeling a little bit frustrated. I also work with a lot of policymakers globally in different countries and states, you know, how do I help them to see this vision? How do I help them to see beyond sort of the ways they have been working or the limitations and challenges they have to see like, okay, we don't have to be prescriptive in how we talk about this, but let's talk about what we ultimately want to get to here in the US, for example. Like, I want access for all for recycling, right? I want to have a blue bin that doesn't require a decoder ring to figure out what goes into it. That's not like a crazy idea, right? So if you start with that, then you're like, okay, well, what can we do to get there, right? Like, what does that need? What kind of money do we need? What kind of policies do we need? How can we get business to, you know, advocate for that too? So I'm sort of taking that idea based in science with a vision of like, what would happen if we didn't do anything? And then saying, okay, what is it that you are empowered to do in your organization or in your sector? And how can we have you link arms with others to kind of do that and get us to scale and make that change faster? So that's the majority of my work. The other piece is helping a huge team of scientists of different disciplines to grow and learn how to do that too, right? And they're really the brains of the operation, if we're being honest. I'm mostly just a mouthpiece at times. I depend on them for all their smarts and to tell me when I'm going crazy. And they're, you know, and so helping them to think about what's that next thing we need to be putting some thought leadership out on? What do we need to be drawing a line in the sand? What do we need to be doing to drive innovation in a really sustainable way? So I feel like there's a lot of different elements that I probably covered there. So you feel free to ask more questions if I went too quickly or didn't get, was too high level. But yeah, it's exciting to be in an organization that wants to do stuff with such integrity, with such a meaningful mission for the planet and for people. Yeah, it's really hard not to, even on the hard days, to not still be happy to go to work every day.
Thank you for that, Erin. And actually, this really does kind of segue into my next question. And it's really about talking about your background. You know, you started in kind of helping product design as it relates to plastic. And so we're curious to understand, what was kind of the moment that you realized you wanted to be working in plastic waste solutions as opposed to helping doing the product design and kind of having this as a resource within the supply chain system?
Yeah. So while I was at HP, I spent a lot of time testing out products and packaging for to meet human needs. And I learned a ton and it was great. But I also started to realize that when we would start to have these questions about like environmental attributes at the time, they were very light and there was zero accountability to them, really. Like I had to use materials that were recyclable, full stop. Well, all materials are recyclable, really, if you recycle them with themselves, right? We just don't have systems that actually do that. And I started to notice that we were just so focused on how we use materials, we didn't really think about the cost that came at to the planet. And as a part of my work in this last few years at WWF, I started to establish the relationship between Hewlett-Packard and World Wildlife Fund on sustainable forestry management. I was working in their pulp and paper, photo paper division, and building chain of custody for sustainable forestry into our production and manufacturing systems. And so I would meet a lot with the WWF team. And we would talk about material science, because while we were talking primarily about pulp and paper, I was like, yeah, but we have these same challenges across plastic or glass or aluminum. Like, what are you guys doing for those? How are you helping companies with those? And at the time, they didn't have any expertise. And that really led to some interesting conversations with some leadership in WWF, in which they're like, hey, do you want to come run the program? So we can engage with companies across the entire material spectrum. Interestingly, I was pregnant at that time. I was like, yeah, this is like, let's just change everything in our life at once. That doesn't sound stressful at all. Let's move to a new city. Let's have a child and let's start a new job in a nonprofit when you had previously just been in the private sector. So I remember the first day and he's like, yeah, I've got your budget for, you know, I've got your salary fixed for 6 months, but you're going to need to go ahead and fundraise for the rest of that. I'm like, oh, wait, what? How does one do these things? You know, what do you want me to work on? Well, I don't know. What do you know? It was like, it was a bit of a crazy time. I don't recommend all those changes at once. If like anyone's asking, it's a lot, but we managed and it sort of evolved into where we are today, which is we have this great foundation that is material agnostic, and honestly, which is like, be thoughtful in how you take things from the planet. Don't take more than the planet can provide, right? And providing guidance on how you do that. Be thoughtful on how you design and use and, you know, and transition that material. But then also we need to get it all back, right? Because we don't have endless supply from the planet on any of those materials. And we need to keep them in that technical system, getting recycled, reused over and over again. And that way they won't end up in nature, you know, clogging up our beaches, entangling species, causing, you know, issues with potentially human health. Like that's the way you avoid all of that impact, is by just keeping those value materials in. And so as we got, is, you know, the 2015 science came out, that Jenna Jembeck, an amazing scientist, she asked a really important question. She said, why do we have plastic waste in nature, really? And it moved us from this very tiny solution set before, which was, let's just make it recyclable, use less, which was clearly, we've got decades of like dirt and waste piling up on beaches, not dirt, that's always been there, just the waste, piling up on beaches, showing that those strategies were just not enough. And then it moved us to a more like, hey, the reason we have so much plastic in oceans is because we don't have waste management on land. 80% of that waste ending up in oceans was coming from land because we have limited and lacking waste management system. It opened up a whole set of opportunities and stakeholders who could get engaged to help solve the problem. You know, it brought that, you know, the team to be much more holistic in our approach. And so that's been really great. And so the last like 6 or 7 years have been really focused on how we drive against that agenda and influence all those stakeholders to play their part. So I think that answered the question. I got rolling there. I apologize.
No, that's totally fine. And I'm really excited that you actually touched on the oceans aspect, because, you know, that's something that we wanted to discuss, and that helps paint a picture about what is going on and the extent of the plastic waste issue. So really, we also want to kind of touch on the debate between individual choices versus corporate responsibility. So within the public discourse on pollution, a lot of it has been centered on individual choices. So people are encouraging behaviors to minimize plastic use. You know, we're seeing campaigns of people to increase zero waste lifestyles in communities worldwide. We have people boycotting single-use plastics like straws. And I'm really curious to understand the level of responsibility that individual choices have on addressing this issue. And then conversely, how are businesses shouldering the burden of plastic waste mitigation and working to address the issue at the source? You touched on that a little bit, but if you could go into a little bit more detail about, you know, your kind of thoughts and insights on this.
Yeah. You know, everybody has an important role to play on this, but there are some that have an outsized role and need to act first, right? And those are businesses and policymakers first and foremost. I need them to change the system that collects and manages all those materials and design the products to work in that system before I can really put a ton of pressure on individuals to take actions over and over again and to change their behavior. There is sort of a chicken and an egg with that, right? Like, their individuals want to act today. They want to take action today because they've seen those pictures. And so, you know, I'm trying to educate and empower them to take the best actions they can, any way they can today, to make meaningful change. But, you know, really spending a lot of my time on those big shifts with businesses and policymakers. And I think this is important. It's interesting. We do conservation in the classroom, which is where we do these live educational pieces on topics. And they do they're live streamed to different classrooms. And I did one on plastic waste to middle schoolers a few weeks ago. And I talked about those tiny actions that I wanted individuals to take around, you know, trying to use reusables in a way they hadn't before, and recycling smart, not recycling, not wish cycling, and, you know, just picking up litter, right? Those are some just easy basics that we want. And what I got back from them was a book of commitments about what each of them was going to do, right? A middle schooler told me that she would stop using the single-use silverware at her school's cafeteria and bring hers with her. That's the level of actions that I want to see right now. And the fact that that middle schooler got it and was like, this is what I'm going to do, I'm like, yes, that's what I want right now, right? And so I do feel like there's going to be a tipping point, right? Where recycling starts to work, where reuse becomes more widely available. And then the public are going to have to really play their part, right? They're going to have to, okay, what now goes in my blue bin? And I'm going to be really good about doing that. Where can I make an extra effort for refill in my home or refill on the go as a form of reuse? Where can I change my behavior to really take advantage of these good recovery systems that are being put into place? So it's tough though. Yeah, I cannot put this on the shoulders of the public. They will just continue to be frustrated by it. And that's not what I want. I need them to ultimately, you know, believe that we're on a pathway to better solutions that'll make their lives easier.
I know Philip had some questions about initiatives that are kind of working to get more higher level action involved. And so I'm going to let Philip kind of take over.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Grace. Well, Erin, we've just heard really exciting news from the UN Environmental Assembly in Nairobi. In the news this week, 200 countries agreed to start negotiations on this international agreement to take action on the plastic crisis, looking toward an internationally and legally binding agreement by 2024. Were you and WWF involved in the lead up to this vote in any ways? And can you help us understand why people are calling it a historic vote? this week?
Yeah, we've definitely been advocating for this for a number of years now. And I think the reason is this, right? No major international issue has ever been tackled at scale without a global treaty, right? A global treaty and a global, it's more than just agreement alignment. It's sort of a symbol of international alignment on a shared threat. It's a binding commitment for countries around the world to work towards sort of this common challenge and how we can neutralize it. It's standing arm in arm, right? And so on an issue like plastic waste, it's really important for us to have that consistent global position about how we're going to solve this. So we've been advocating for this at this stage in the process for the negotiations to open on what this agreement could look like. And we're really pleased with the results because one, as you saw in the language of the announcement, is that we are aiming for a legally binding agreement, which talks about the ambition around this issue. It also said that it's going to put together an international negotiating committee, and that's going to be the committee that's sort of working towards figuring out and negotiating what's going to go in it by 2024. Some global agreements can take up to a decade to align on, but all of the countries around the world said, we do not have that long to wait. We've got to get this. We got to get the agreement in place by 2024. And I feel like we're in this point in time, right? We have the conflict right now in the Ukraine, and we're just feeling the pressure of like the divisiveness of the world right now. And this was just this moment of hope. It was like this moment where we could all come together and say, yeah, we're going to solve this together. We know we need to get all countries involved. We need to empower countries. We need to provide guidance through a framework. It needs to include the entire life cycle of plastic. It has to have financial mechanisms and policies, and it needs to have a common language for metrics and reporting so we can all set targets that mean something. So we're pretty excited, if you can't tell from my voice. I feel like when I watched the gavel come down yesterday morning when I was watching the closing plenary and the standing ovation that followed for that resolution, and to be a part of something like that, I was just like, okay, we did something. Like, I know it's just the first step, right? This milestone, and the work really begins, but like we did that. We got over 100 businesses to support that, to say, yes, we need this, even if it includes virgin reductions. We got over 500 NGOs to agree on something, which, y'all, that's a big deal. And then you have all of the member states saying yes, and over 2 million individuals demanding it. It was just like, wow, I didn't know we had it in us, world, but we do. So very excited about that.
It's a huge result. I mean, for those of us on the outside, the level of support was staggering.
Right. Yeah. I think that's how we got so ambitious and what the results were, because we saw a whole bunch of different outcomes coming out of this last week of debates. And the fact that what we got had everything we wanted in it, that's a really good starting point for the debate.
Erin, a lot of people wonder how they, as one individual within a global corporation in the private sector, can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And we often hear discouragement. People who have the same motivations you do, but find with their particular company, they feel they just can't move things forward. Can you give a couple of pieces of advice for people who are also mothers who deeply love their child, or people who have the same feeling of connection with nature and want their work to be meaningful and to be pointing in the right direction, who want to be change agents? What words of advice would you give to people like that?
Let's start with don't give up hope. I mean, it can feel overwhelming at times, but there's so many little things that we can do that we have the authority to do. And I think it's finding those little gems within the controls you have or your role in that. You know, if you're a procurement officer, what kind of procurement policies could you put into place? How could you inspire leadership to be a bit more ambitious with what you're asking for? How can you think about finding a business case or cost savings in some of these opportunities, because there is low-hanging fruit there? You can start to prove the value of sustainability and get that buy-in before you make those bigger asks. There is a ton of great case studies that showcase how you get started. I think the other piece is about continuing to educate yourself on the issues. so you can advocate internally for why we need to protect what the world provides for us, mostly for free, in order for us to keep the doors open of our companies. Like that, at the end of the day, those corporations that are understand that they depend on a healthy planet in order to continue to grow and prosper are the ones that are investing today in how to protect those resources more. And so I think there is a great case to be made with that. I also think that these days, companies understand that they need that sustainability is something that talent talent retention requires, right? They know that being responsible for the footprint that they have on the planet is something that our employees are expecting now. So I encourage pushing for that, because that is a really, that's an evolution that didn't exist before. And I would like us to hold companies accountable internally and externally for, you know, their responsibility to the communities they impact and to the planet that they impact. So, but yeah, don't lose hope. Little actions matter. They matter every day. Even if you just get people to do a beach cleanup or a trail cleanup, you know, or you recycle in the office, like those things matter. It all matters.
As we come toward the end of the podcast, I find myself thinking about your comment earlier about not being able to separate your work, your love of nature, your love of your family, the way that they all connect. And it makes me want to ask the really big question. What do you most hope to achieve over the course of your career? So if you dream big, you know, mm-hmm. about the impact that your work might have, and imagine yourself looking back over your career, though I can't picture you ever in a rocking chair, but nonetheless, as you look back at the very end, what would be your dream to have achieved through the years that you've had in your professional life?
No.
And be concrete, if there's a specific thing, or if it's a broad, I don't know how you're going to want to answer it.
So I want to get like 10 years from now, honestly, and I want to look back and see that we have recycling and reuse systems at scale. Like all of the work, all of the a million conversations and presentations and talks and quotes that I put out there are all driving people to be excited for that same thing, right? And get us there. If I look back and see that we've made inroads on that, and I don't think I'll be happy with incremental, because it won't have been enough. It'll have to have been big. I'll feel really good about being one of the cogs in the wheel that drove that change, right? I think I'll also be not maybe heading for a rocking chair. I hope not a wheelchair, but a rocking chair. But I think I do want to move to, you know, after I finish, you know, well, after I create the momentum and create some of this change and help that happen, I think I do like the idea of like maybe working at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation or something where I can do more, you know, local conservation. But I want to look back and know that what I did, I finished what I started. You know, I can't imagine walking away from this now. And I want my daughter to, you know, right now she thinks that I, you know, she thinks I saved the world, which I think is really, she's so funny. I'm like, well, yeah, not really. You love how kids sort of just see things in big sweeping movements. But I want her to be proud. I want her to be like this, you know, this is something that my mother stood for, that she did for me, for, you know, the planet. And so I would like her to feel proud of me. And I'd like her to also be a good human who's nice to people. If I can get that first and foremost, that would be great.
We look back in a dozen years and we are seeing recycling and reuse systems at scale, and that we have achieved that.
Yeah.
And I want to ask this question because there are people in other domains who are trying to achieve also BHAGs, like the big, hairy, audacious goal. What will it have taken? Mm-hmm. So what kinds of partnerships? What role of individual consumers? What role of courageous leaders in multiple sectors? Just talk to us a little bit. Like, what are your bullet points?
Yeah.
Because people can generalize. If they see how you think about your issue, they can do that in their field as well.
Yeah. I think it starts with policy reform, big, and maybe it's not full reform, but policies towards outcomes, not incremental steps. So we need to have the funding mechanisms and the framework around what can be in the shared system, and policy needs to drive that, right? So we need to have that state, national, global. That is really important because that enables the infrastructure for collection, processing, which could be cleaning and refill or could be recycling of those systems, right? Then you need to have businesses who are willing to change their products to fit that shared system. I think on the reuse side, that is going to be, it's going to be about a shared standard system because we can't have a million different reuse systems. The public cannot manage that in their mind, right? So we need to, and that is hard because it's going to be a competitive thing, right? They want to put out the best, newest, fanciest reuse right now. But what I really need is like for beverage companies to do the same one, right? Like I don't want to have a different one for all the different beverages. So that's going to be, I think like that's going to be one of the things is if they can really figure out how to do it together. We have so many proof points of this working. Electronics, your USB, auto industry. Those are industries that have already figured out how to standardize things. So for reuse, we're going to have to see some of that. So big commitments on the companies to really rethink how they're making products and rethink what is competitive, right? Their product itself, what goes in that material, that needs to be the competitive advantage. So, and then finally, individuals, right? We live for convenience, right? As a mom, snacks are, you know, really important, you know, and I trying to figure out how we make things work in our lives, in our busy lives, but still make us feel like are still a step in the right direction, you know? And so for right now, it's about making those steps about in your home, in your lives, what changes can you make today that are better? And then when these reuse and recycling systems, you know, get put into place, being a good human and doing what you need to do to, you know, work in those systems, right? My mom is a notorious recycler and I love her for it because she just wants everything to be recyclable. So it all just goes in that blue bin. And I'm like, no, just what goes in. And so it shouldn't be that hard in the future system, right? Like I said, I want it to be like super simple. You're like, just put it all in. But also you may need to remember to bring that reusable, refillable thing. You may have to pay a little bit more. And that is a hard ask because I know there are so many communities that are struggling economically, but we have been pushing costs onto the environment as a whole community for decades. That's just because it gives us so much for free that we don't even account for. And so while I want most of that cost to be absorbed by businesses and by governments, there is going to be a cost to some of these, you know, more environmentally sustainable products. So, but I think that that's what it is, but that's going to come after all that systems change happens. So I think those are my big asks.
That's a fantastic answer, concrete in the way that we need it. Erin, the podcast is known for always closing with the same final question. What gives you hope for you as a leader, as a mom, as an individual who loves nature? What is it that gives you hope?
Well, after yesterday, that gave me hope, right? That's really concrete. But I think in general, I'm not alone in my passion and in my mission. I'm not a woman standing out there fighting for something all by myself. There are so many people who come from different places and different experiences who want the same thing. And I feel like we can continue to build off of that, like how we drive for outcomes in a way that's really intentional. And so that's, I think, what helps me to sleep at night. And I think as a mom, what gives me hope is that my kid is already better than I am. She's growing up in a different world than I did. She has, you know, her eyes are just more open to things. And so I think that our next generations are going to be ready to, you know, take the baton, and they are going to have new ideas. They are going to be smarter and they are going to be more thoughtful because they grew up like knowing that this was the only planet that they had to protect. Right. So I'm hopeful because people are smarter than me and they're coming up next to take over. but yeah, I think it's all those things.
Thank you, Erin. That's beautiful.
If you'd like to learn more about Erin and the work she does with WWF, you can follow the organization World_Wildlife on Instagram and at @sustainableErin with E-R-I-N for Erin's Twitter. Thank you to our audience for tuning in, and be sure to be on the lookout for our next episode coming out soon.